Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Her first novel was called Housekeeping, released back in 1980. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and has since been described as one of the greatest novels of all time. 5, 10, 15 years passed, and then finally, 24 years later, the second novel arrived. It was called Gilead. It went on to win the Pulitzer. The third novel, called Home, won Britain's prestigious Orange Prize for Fiction. Prolific she is not, and perhaps that is why each one of Marilyn Robinson's novels is a masterpiece. I am so glad we get to speak to her. Marilyn Robinson, welcome to Open House.
Oh, thank you very much.
One reviewer wrote of you, I quote, "I'm not saying that you're actually dead if you haven't read Marilyn Robinson, but I honestly couldn't say you're fully alive." Setting the flattery aside for a moment, I'd love to know why you write. Is it because, as some have said, literature does actually help us to become more human, maybe even more alive?
Well, you know, I actually believe that's true. I think that there are a number of things that people can do to become more human, you know, arts and kinds of service to other people and so on. But I think that it is true of writing also, that it makes very deep demands on one's mind, you know, on experience, the ability to articulate the meaning that inheres in experience, the ability to make use of language that really exploits the capacities of language. All of these things are a very deep sorts of explorations of what it is to be a human being.
Yes, very much. You started reading at a fairly early age. Moby Dick, I think it was the first book you read at the age of 9 or something, and you just kept on reading. Tell me about that reading life that developed early, and then how it developed into a desire to write.
I'd read a good many books before I tried Moby Dick, but I did start Moby Dick in the fourth grade, and and I've read it many times since then.
Yeah.
I don't know where these impulses come from. I don't know. Right, I wrote poetry when I was a small child. I realized at a certain point that it was bad poetry and started writing fiction. And it's simply been something that's been natural to me, the way that for some people music is, or drawing and painting. It feels natural to me.
Yes.
But you wouldn't know from my output, but that's true.
Yes. Well, that's a story in itself, which I want to get to. What was your family life like, Marilyn? Did you grow up in a family of readers?
Well, I have an older brother who did everything before I did by at least 2.5 years and taught me everything that he learned through our entire childhood. And I think that he was the major sort of formative figure for me. My parents were too, but my brother has always had this sort of fierce pedagogical impulse. He's a professor now, and I was his first audience. And he did me a world of good. I hope I did him some good also.
And you talked about when you were a child, you started off with poetry, you came to the realization the poetry wasn't too good, so you started writing fiction. Was there a moment where you really clicked on, though, to your voice? Or did that come later on when you started writing and indeed published Housekeeping? You know, that writer's voice that one discovers after a period of time of writing, trying various ways of crafting sentences out.
Yes, well, I actually took a creative writing class when I was in college, and I had a very fine teacher, John Hawkes, a sort of experimental novelist. I would just turn in things that I wrote to him, and he would mark the places where he said, "This is your voice." And he sort of trained me to understand when I was writing authentically for myself, you know.
Mm.
And of course, it takes a lot of refinement beyond that point, but his simply sensitizing me in that way was probably the most valuable learning experience I've ever had.
Yes. How old were you when that happened?
I was a sophomore at university. I would have been, I suppose, 19.
Well, it was great to have that earlier on, isn't it? Because for some writers it comes a lot later when they finally discover, well, yes, this is my authentic voice. Wonderful to have somebody point it out to you.
It was a wonderfully valuable thing for me, no question about it.
You mentioned in a newspaper article once that you've never felt precisely suited to life in the world, I think the actual phrase was, that it kind of took you a while to find your place within it, I guess. You were kind of a little bit bewildered as a child. What was happening there for you?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose, I mean, it's very strange, you know, looking back, it seems as if my life has just fallen out perfectly, you know, and everything I could have aspired to, you know, I've more or less enjoyed. But my life has also been extremely unusual. I could not have anticipated it. And so I have to feel as though I have never been suited to what you might call a typical life, but at the same time, by the grace of God, I've never had to live a typical life. You know, I actually have been able to write and teach and study and do the things that are important to me.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. We're talking to Marilyn Robinson tonight, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of books like Gilead, Housekeeping, Home, and a number of other both essays and also non-fiction works. This is Open House, openhouseonline.com.au for the podcast. Let's talk about those three main novels then, which are the fruit of 28 odd years worth of work, and perhaps you can give us some writing tips along the way, if that's not asking a little bit too much of you, Marilyn.
I give them out all the time.
Yes, we're not paying for it though, so let's talk about the first novel, Housekeeping. You wrote Housekeeping in a dark room in France with the shutters pulled down to escape the inquisitive glances of the kids outside, and it did wonders for your recalling of memories, which then went into the book, didn't it?
Absolutely. That was another strange and very important experience for me, really having to delve so deeply into what I remembered of a landscape that I actually had left almost 20 years before, you know. I was amazed to find out what my memory had retained. And the selection that my memory had made of things that, you know what I mean? It's almost as if your memory has a different aesthetic than you are consciously aware of having. So that this sort of strangely beautiful world can be conjured out of things that you perhaps never realized you noticed, you know? It was an amazing experience. I think that people undervalue their memories enormously because they so rarely make really deep demands on them.
And while we're talking about the tips then, here you are writing Housekeeping back in, well, late 70s, released in 1980 in France in this dark room. What are your optimal physical and emotional, even spiritual conditions for writing, for you personally?
Well, when I'm writing fiction, I like to be in a relatively enclosed, familiar space by myself, very comfortable. I write with a pen and a spiral notebook when I'm writing fiction. I like to be sort of self-forgetful, you know. I'll do everything that I can to sort of forget my own physical existence. It's almost like, you know, you can get into a state of concentration that almost feels like dreaming. And that's something that I cultivate. It is concentration, though. It's very self-critical.
Yeah. And are you averse to computers, or does that come later on?
No, I'm not averse to them. When I'm writing fiction, I write in longhand and then put it into computer and usually make changes of a certain kind, minimal changes, when I'm putting it in the computer.
Yeah.
I write nonfiction basically on the computer. It's quite a different experience.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't it? So what does writing in longhand give you that sitting at a computer doesn't give you for fiction writing?
Well, there's a way in which the words that appear in my handwriting seem mine. Words that appear on a screen seem sort of public, something that I'm appropriating out of some general possession of language, you know. And so a word in my own handwriting is more of the way the word feels when I think it. It's like that,
yes.
You know.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned before earlier, it was 24 years between Housekeeping, the first novel, and then the second novel, Gilead. There are a number of non-fiction releases in there as well. There was a book of essays and a book there about British nuclear policy, of all things, as well. But tell me about the wait, the giant wait between those two novels. It wasn't just a case of writer's block, I hope.
Oh, no, not really. When I started writing Housekeeping, or chose, you know, to expand what I had been writing into a novel, it was a solution for a problem to me. A lot of what I saw in writing that was contemporary then seemed very conventional to me. They have a very narrow range of subjects and demographics and all the rest of it.
Mm.
And I could escape that by, because I had grown up in a place that was sort of untouched as a fictional landscape. I had it all to myself. And that solved the problem for me, that a feeling that I was writing authentically. But then I didn't want to do it twice. I didn't want that solution to the problem to govern every choice that I made afterward. And so I took a lot of time reading, basically, to try to change my mind, to give myself a way of thinking about things that I could identify as more authentically my own.
Yes.
Than if I had simply written in the stream of what was then conventional writing.
Was there any pressure from the publisher towards you, though? Because once you've had some success, and even though Housekeeping was a slow burner, really, it then started to develop and then grew in popularity, grew and grew and grew. In 1987, it became a film. But after the success, was there any pressure that you felt from the publisher? Come on, we've got to have the follow-up. We've got to have the follow-up. I mean, they wouldn't have been expecting to have waited 24 years for the follow-up.
They are utterly considerate and impeccable in their all my dealings with them. They've only been gracious, only been patient.
Mm.
Over 24 years, I had no pressure. I think that's quite amazing.
I think so. In fact, you've said before, just talking about the reason why, is because you couldn't find, or you didn't want to repeat yourself. You didn't want to go over old ground. You've said somewhere before, if you know where an idea comes from, you do not pursue it. That shows quite a commitment to your craft, that if it's going to be in any way formulaic or any way kind of previously done, you dismiss it. Tell me about the experience of then reading for 24 years and then finally getting to the point where you recognized you had something with Gilead.
Well, I loved reading for 24 years. It just makes me wish life was were longer than it is.
Yeah.
I'd like to spend another 24 years that way. But it was, I didn't really decide to write another novel. I was just sort of by myself in a hotel on the East Coast, and I had time on my hands and a notebook and a pen. And I suddenly had this feeling that I knew a man in a situation, and I began writing. And lots of things that I'd been reading, of course, came into play, but I didn't intentionally draw on them. I was not reading in order to write fiction. I would not have been surprised, frankly, if I'd never written fiction again.
Hmm.
It just did present itself to me.
Hmm. Gilead tells the story of John Ames, this Congregational minister who prepares for his death by writing a letter to his son, kind of giving an account of his life of sorts, really, his relationships, his beliefs, his struggles and things. And you actually said that Ames' character voice just kind of came to you one day. It wasn't as much as you conjured him up, as much as he came to you.
That's really true. I always assumed that if I wrote fiction again, I would write from a woman's viewpoint. You know, I thought it just came naturally to me, and that's what I would do. And then, lo and behold, I had this male voice in my mind, and it was, people ask me, you know, how did I do it, and all that sort of thing. I never experienced any difficulty. It always felt natural to me. I just felt as if I knew his voice. It was a nice experience from that point of view. You know, it was pleasing to write because I felt so at ease with him.
Yes, yes. We'll talk about Home, the third novel, in just a second. But with Home, you said that you couldn't leave one of the Gilead characters, Jack, alone. It's as if fictional characters chase out the writer rather than the other way around.
It really seems that way. Mm. Not only that, but they end books. You know, one of the oddest experiences of my life was when I was writing Housekeeping, which was my first full fiction, you know, the first thing I ever completed. I realized at a certain point that the characters were ending the book, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Was there any argument? I don't want to end the book now.
I didn't want to. I felt abandoned. It's very strange.
What is that? I mean, what is that? Yeah, can you describe what is going on in that whole experience?
You know, I really can't. But I do think that in a way, now, you know, in this modern period, people feel as if nothing can exist that we cannot make a sort of an analytic account of, you know. And I think that, in fact, if you give yourself over to your mind, you find it has a much larger life than anything that we can describe for it or make a rational account of, given present understanding. You know,
yes, yes.
I think the mind is spontaneously ordering.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it loves complexity. It loves resolution. That these are sort of its gifts in a way, and that any art is actually giving the mind the occasion to express these gifts that it simply intrinsically has.
Yes, nicely put. This is Open House. We're talking to Marilyn Robinson. While we're still talking about Gilead, your most well-known novel, given the Pulitzer Prize for it, both the characters in Gilead, I mean, Gilead is all about this minister talking to his young son about things, but both the characters in Gilead and also Home engage in some really sustained theological argument because of the nature of John Ames and then all the conversations that start from him. Most authors would be anxious about doing that for fear of alienating or losing their readers. But you weren't, and it worked for you. But were you ever nervous about that this sustained biblical theological discussions about God, life, Christian faith, etc., would actually be of some sort of problem to your reader?
Well, I just write what I want to write. I mean, but it's also true that if I had said, you know, I write sort of under cover of darkness. I mean, nobody knows what I'm doing until it's done. But if I had told people that I was writing a book about a minister dying in Iowa in 1956, you know what I mean? That is the most unsaleable book you could possibly imagine, I think. But it was on my mind. It was very strong, you know, it was very strong in my imagination. I had to write it, and anything could have happened to it. But I think I found out that readers have much wider sympathies or tolerances or something than they're normally credited with having.
Yes, well, that's true, because if you went and analyzed the story and plotline and everything that as you were writing the book, if you put that into a classic book submission document to a publisher, yes, it wouldn't probably light up their lives, that's for sure. I don't know what demographic this is going to be.
I can imagine them having a very good laugh over it, right?
Yes. This is probably a good place to raise the significance of the 16th century church reformer John Calvin. You've done significant research and written extensively about him and his theology, his teachings. How would you describe his influence on your work? It really has been quite significant.
Yes, I think that the thing that I think is most moving to me and most influential to me about Calvin's theology is the way in which it makes all experience saturated with meaning, of the highest order of meaning. The idea that God is continuously present to consciousness and that every moment of experience is something that's being, in effect, given to you, displayed to you for your comprehension or instruction, or so that you see the sort of signature beauty of God in what is presented to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, it's like experience is never static and it's never remote. It's always something that, for every human consciousness, is addressed precisely to that consciousness. It's always full of meaning. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a very profound aesthetic vision.
Yes, and it goes back to this issue of perception that you talked about before as being one of the themes of your work too, our being almost having eyes to see the beauty that there is in the world, the meaning that there is in the world, and perhaps even the activity of God in the world, I wonder.
Yes, certainly, I would say so. I think that one of the things that religion does that makes it so powerful for people is that it queries experience, you know? It gives people the language to inquire into meaning in a way that nothing else really does. And, I mean, that certainly is how my characters experience it, I would say.
Yes. Well, you've written about John Calvin and studied him very, very seriously. You've written books about Christian ministers. We've even seen in your books characters who are people of faith who aren't ridiculed, which is so often the case in so much fiction work or film work, that just there's this caricature. Well, of course, the minister has got to be some sort of abusing priest or something. You know, you've never kind of gone down that path. Tell me about your own dawning interest in God personally. Was it something that started at a particular time in your life, as a child, as a teenager, later on?
I think that my religious sensibility from a very early point was influenced by the fact that I lived in a very beautiful mountain landscape, very thinly populated part of the country. My relatives, nothing passed their notice as far as how beautiful things were. My attention was continuously drawn to that. And it was a very impressive landscape, you know, the sound that mountains make when the winds blow and all that sort of thing was really amazing, this enormous lake that the town was on and so on.
Yes.
And there was something sort of theological just about the scale of things and the otherness of things. And I think, you know, then of course I had more ordinary childhood instruction, but I think that my idea of God and my, frankly, very strong sense of the presence of God came out of landscape as much as anything else.
That's really fascinating. I've spent the last couple of years really kind of looking into this notion of beauty. It's something that is so precious to me. I mean, a walk through beauty does so many things. It refreshes me, it stimulates creativity for me, but it really does reflect for me the character of God, the nature of God. I feel close to God in beauty, as well as in study and other things, but that is such a profound thing. And it's obviously had a very significant role for you in your own personal journey as well, in your own, as you said, religious or spiritual sensibilities. There is a sense, and John Calvin was all about this as well, that beauty does actually disclose something of God's nature to us. It's very clouded often, and yet there is something there in which the beauty that you were talking about, reflecting on the sound of the wind through the trees, even the trees themselves swaying in the wind, all of those kinds of things, say something to us about the Creator that made them.
Yes, and for Calvin, I mean, it's the generosity of God toward beauty is a major mode of the generosity of God toward human beings. It's like a compliment that he pays them, you know, that he can give them these wonderful things and they will see them as beautiful, you know.
Yes.
People are wrong in what they say about Calvin. There's a deep immediacy and a real courtesy in his imagination or his understanding of the relationship of God toward human beings. And the fact that he gives them, you know, the spectacular beauty of the stars and all that, that's part of the sort of graciousness, hospitality of God toward the human.
Yes, very much so. He, you're right, he has been caricatured by those who haven't read him as being kind of somebody very dour, you know, all about the people that are in and out because of predestination and so on. But he was quite an amazing, marvellous intellect. So how would you describe your own faith today, Marilyn? Obviously, it's of the Christian persuasion. How would you describe it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm in Princeton, New Jersey, as we speak, and I'm working with 12 practicing theologians who want to improve their writing of theology. They're from a very diverse set of backgrounds, and it's a little bit like a retreat. You know, we have one building all to ourselves and all the resources of it, and so on. And we're all talking about religion and theology and all this from various perspectives. And it's interesting because on the one hand, it makes you feel very strongly the reality of this shared vocabulary. At the same time, that just by complicating, it makes these things a little bit more complex than you perhaps thought they were as you entered. Complex in a sense of enriched rather than complicated, you know. I've been a member of a church all my adult life, really, and studied theology, and it's a sort of nexus of profoundly important things that I'm not really terribly good at articulating. I let John Ames do it for me.
Yes. One of your characters telling you what to write and what you believe. Fascinating. This is Open House right across the nation. And Marilyn Robinson is our special guest tonight, author of Pulitzer Prize-winning books like Gilead and also Housekeeping and Home. Now let's talk about Home. Home is a fascinating thing that you've done there because you retrace the story of the second novel, Gilead, but you do it through the eyes of another family in the same town. Home focuses on Jack, the black sheep, who returns home to Gilead and to his dying father. Now, you've said elsewhere that Home was kind of the prodigal son story based in the book of Luke in the New Testament. That's the background story to Home, and in fact, it's actually a default narrative for you. How is the prodigal son a default narrative for you?
Well, it's a very beautiful parable. If you know, speaking in literary terms, that is really a magnificent piece of work, that parable. The thing that's fascinating about it, of course, is that you can return to it over and over again and think about it over and over again. And the given of the parable in the Bible is that the Father is God,
yes.
Even though it's given to us in sort of worldly terms. And then you start to thinking, but in the real world, the Father is not God. And he can have every impulse of generosity and love and still not be able to achieve the reconciliation. You know, I mean, there are limits to what people can do. And then there's also the fact, of course, that the parable ends with simply the return of the son, whereas in actual human life, you know, the son returns, then you have the son to deal with.
Yes.
You know, and other all the complexities of life that have accumulated to that point and so on. So I just, in a way, I took the parable and sort of planted it on the ground.
Well, you've spent so many years now at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, a somewhat prestigious workshop where I think writers from around the world are clamoring to get in. Before we let you go, I'm just wondering whether we can actually get a bit of a mini Idaho workshop from Marilyn Robinson. I'll give you an incomplete sentence and perhaps you can finish it for us, okay? How does that sound?
I don't know, these tests, you know, they make me nervous.
Well, there's no right or wrong, just looking for to lever some of that wisdom from you. Question number one, or statement number one, the technique I wish I'd discovered earlier is?
Not to be discouraged by what I used to take to be writing blocks. Now I know that just means I have to stop and think about something.
Well, actually, that leads to my second question, which was my finest cure for mental block is. just stopping and thinking about it, hey?
Exactly, or not thinking about it. That's the thing, you know, I'm always talking to people about the capacities of the mind, but one thing is that sometimes if you have asked yourself a question you don't know the answer to, or a problem that you don't know the solution to, and then you sort of put it out of your mind. It's like when you are trying to think of a word or a name or a telephone number, and then a month passes and you don't need it anymore, and you wake up in the middle of the night knowing what it is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And you realize that your mind has been working on this problem silently all this time.
Yes.
You know? The same sort of thing can happen when you're trying to work something out. You put the problem to yourself, you go about your life, and your mind remembers the problem and works on it. It's amazing.
It is amazing. I think of the Latin phrase, solvitas perambulum, solve it as you walk. There's almost a sense when you do hit that kind of block, put it aside, go for a walk, go do something else. Like you said, go to bed, go to sleep.
Exactly.
You never know when the insight
exactly.
will come. All right, well, third statement. My best creative insights come when I...
go for a walk. I don't know. I really don't know what happens. I wish that I could create situations in which my best insights would be predictable, but I can't really do that.
No. It's, you really are just waiting for that phone call or for that knock on the door from one of your characters, like John Ames, aren't you?
Yes, exactly.
Statement number four, I come up with my best metaphors when...
I really try. I don't know. I mean, you know, a metaphor is something that you have to sort of reject the first four or five versions of, you know, in order before you refine it to a point where it means what you want it to mean.
So how much time do you spend on metaphors? Because, I mean, sometimes have you worked hours to get just the right metaphor in a particular place?
That happens. I'm not so aware of it, though. You know, I'm not really on the clock, you know. But if something will occur to me, and then I think, how can I articulate that? And then I maybe go for a walk, you know, and run it through my mind over and over again until it sort of becomes refined. You know, it comes down to its essentials. It sounds mm-hmm. the way it's supposed to. But I don't, you know, I'm not terribly aware. I have no work ethic in the normal sense, and so I'm never aware of how much time anything takes me. I just do it till it's done. Yes.
Statement number five, when I write, I always... You can answer this
seclude
whichever way
myself.
You like. Seclude yourself?
Yes.
Solitude is important?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it is.
Number six, when I write, I never...
I never make myself write when I'm not writing well.
So you do... You...
That's another no-no.
So what, you get up one morning and you start working and what, it's just not, the muse just isn't there?
I write a paragraph, I look at it, I think, I don't like that paragraph at all, and there's no point going on unless I have a better place to enter into the fiction than that, and I put down my pen and go away.
And when do you return? Later that afternoon or the next day?
It could be either of those, or it could be the next week. Okay. I'm a bad example.
there was 24 years between your first and second novels.
24 wonderful years.
Yes. Okay, statement number seven, and I know that we've kind of touched on this, but I'm wondering where else you might go with it. I know a book is finished when?
When the characters begin to walk away.
That's what I was expecting. When they begin to walk away, wow. And how about this one? The finest advice I can give to a young writer is...
To write what you want to write. Do not try to calculate a market. For heaven's sakes, don't make some imitation of something that looks like it's hot at the time. Write out of your own deepest impulse.
Sounds like great advice. And when it's all said and done, what would you like your writing to do in the end, Marilyn?
I like the idea that my writing has a life from the point of view of other people, and it has readers, you know. I hope it's a gentle presence in the world. I don't write intentionally beyond that, just trying to make things that seem beautiful to me, basically.
Yes. Well, Marilyn Robertson, I've so enjoyed our conversation. I really thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
Yeah, it's award-winning author and essayist, Marilyn Robertson.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.